I saw some stuff that horrified me. So I changed everything. I left the marriage and I left the job, and I had a chance to go and volunteer on a radio station in Zambia. And so that's what I went and did.
In this episode, we went deep. I caught up with my friend and inspiring force of nature, Angela Barnett. Angela is a writer and professional brand storyteller with over 15 years of experience in marketing, but she is most passionate about her talk entitled Pretty Smart. She equips young teens with critical thinking around the endless media and advertising messages around beauty and how it's defined. She talks candidly about her battles overcoming bulimia, importance of staying creative as a parent, her approach to writing, and why beauty is more powerful as a feeling than it is a look. Angela, welcome
Victor,
to the show.
Thank you very much.
And how was your morning?
Quite good. Crisp winter morning.
And we're in your house right now in Piha.
We are in my house.
So what's a perfect day in Piha like for you?
Not going to work. Not leaving Piha. We call it going over the hill. It's just a tiny hill that you have to go up to get out of Piha. And so often in the weekends we will say to our children, no, we're not doing anything over the hill. So a perfect day is you've got everything you need. You've got a bottle of wine for later if you need it. You've got enough milk in the fridge. You've got coffee to make. And you don't leave at all. So you'll spend some time down in the ocean. You'll try and have no plans. And that's kind of a perfect day here.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a little bit trapped in time.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
I love it. So if we rewind a bit, Zambia and Africa, how does that come into your story?
Okay. Growing up, left home, worked in marketing, advertising, worked in an advertising agency for 5 years, and sort of found myself living a life that didn't quite feel like my own. I always had this feeling, even though I was living this sort of swanky life at Saatchi and Saatchi in Wellington, I often felt like in meetings that I wasn't an imposter, but that I had another life waiting for me somewhere else and I didn't quite know how to access it. So I ended up changing everything about that life. Like I was in a marriage that I was not happy in and didn't feel right, and the work didn't feel right somehow. I kept seeing a lot of money go to waste from egos and sort of clients making decisions to throw away a $400,000 campaign because a new person had come in, a head of marketing, and didn't want that idea anymore. So I saw some stuff that horrified me. So I changed everything. I left the marriage and I left the job, and I had a chance to go and volunteer on a radio station in Zambia. And so that's what I went and did. So
what a big change. And
it was a really
big change.
And
how long were you down there for?
I was there, living there for 6 months. And sometimes it felt like 3 years and other times it felt like 6 weeks. I was away for longer. I then spent some time traveling around Africa and then I did go back there afterwards. So yeah, it was kind of the whole process was an interesting year out of my life or into my life.
What do you think you discovered about yourself during that year in Africa? Do you think you found what you were looking for?
I found a truth that I didn't want to discover, but I'm really glad I discovered it. It's that crazy old Confucius saying, wherever you go, there you are. So probably the big revelation for me was that if there were things that I was unhappy with about myself before I went, they came with me to Africa. Just because I changed circumstances and I went off and I thought I was going to go and do something that felt like to me I was more focused on other people rather than myself or my career or my life or my relationship. I discovered that if I haven't actually got that sort of base work sorted, yeah, I just heaped it all in my suitcase with me and it followed me there.
Yeah.
So I was still the same person when I got there. And I probably wasn't as useful as I could have been if I hadn't run away from my life so much and thought a little bit longer and harder about how could I be useful there rather than, oh, I'm just going to give all of this up and I'm going to go and do something else without, you know, I didn't even do that much research before I went about how I could be useful. So
you're very useful now. You're a writer and you're a speaker. And which came first?
The writing.
The writing.
The writing.
Can you tell me
definitely came
about
first.
how you got into that?
Yes, I can. So it was actually after Africa. I did a bit of writing when I was there because I was having experiences that were blowing my mind. I started writing them down for myself, and then I also started writing them as articles and sending them off to magazines just because I was, you know, I was wanting to share what I was experiencing. And I'd been at this all-night ceremony when a girl first comes of age, which means she first gets her period, which means she's now can officially become a woman. And so this ceremony was very eye-opening for me. And I'd written the whole story up and I sent it off, and the rejection came back as, I'm afraid there was too many labias in the story for us to publish it. So, I mean, I was just, you know, I was just in the world that I was in. I was like, okay, so they do this, they measure the labia, they make sure it's, you know, it's this length, and then if it's right, then they tip water over the father's head to say the girl is ready for marriage because the labia's been checked. Like, I mean, I was just, I was writing down what I was witnessing. And
Western so, autocorrect wasn't on.
I know. Too many labias for this. So that's when I started. And then when I came back, I was exhilarated and high on life, but I was quite broke. And so I went back to what I know, which was a marketing role after Africa. But that it was an incredibly creative young company. And one of the guys that I worked with there, he was the first person who, and often he just takes one person. He said to me, "You can write. Why don't you write more?" So then I started.
Amazing. And speaking, if we jump straight from writing into speaking, can we talk about how that started?
Yes. Yeah. The two very different, they're kind of equally scary, writing, speaking, because you're exposing yourself in some form and putting it out there. And both make my heart beat, the idea of doing them, for different reasons. I mean, writing is measured, so you can control every word on the page, but you can't control how people receive it. That's once it goes out, it's, you let it go. And speaking is sort of the same. You can manage and figure out every word that you think you're going to say, but you can't control how other people relate to it. And so they're kind of similar but different. So the speaking started in, it was when I was a mum, and you came to visit us, remember?
I did, yeah.
So you saw me when I first started this. So we was living in this camp in Northern California that looks after kids from San Francisco in their underprivileged kids that come up. This camp that's been running for 80 years. Everyone working there was doing something amazing for the kids. So there was lots of counselors that were coming and that were hired, and Renee was working, my partner was working there, and everyone else had a job. And because our children were so young, I didn't have a job. And it was maybe a bit of an ego thing, but I didn't like just being a mum. I found that really hard as a identity that, I'm just a mum now. That's all that I do. I don't have anything else to contribute. And then I thought about it for, we were there for 3.5 years, and it was in the second year I'd been watching all the girls come into camp. And I used to watch the world that I came from was predominantly a split of Caucasian and Pacific Island. And if you're in the Caucasian white girl scenario, the girls would all talk about their shape, the size of their body. And what I noticed there is that it was mostly in, you're either black or you're white there. There's hardly any in between. There's no, you're African-American or you're not. And those girls used to talk about their shade. So I noticed this real difference in their hierarchy and how they judge each other. And so because I'd worked in marketing and advertising for years, I thought, what if I could show these girls how a lot of the messaging that they've received about what's attractive and what's not attractive and what they think boys or other girls think is attractive, a lot of it is a construct. And if they could see through it, maybe it might be easier for them. So then I developed, I wrote to everyone I knew in marketing and advertising, like, I'm looking for the staff and examples, and most people didn't get back to me. So I just researched, and then I just put together a presentation for them, which you saw. And I started off with the 16-year-old girls. It's an hour long. And they would all, you know, nod and agree. And then they'd say, this is great, but you need to talk to the 14-year-old girls. They had, you know, different names based on Pomo girls for 15, 16, Iroquois girls for 13, 14. They said, you need to talk to them. I'd do the talk with them. And they'd go, you need to talk to the 11 and 12-year-old girls, because this is when they're starting to think about it and it's starting to affect them. We're already been affected by this. And so that's sort of where I settled. And then when I started there, then the girls started to say, can you come and talk to my school back in San Francisco? So
wow, that's amazing.
How it started.
So can you talk a little bit about, I'm going to be jumping around a bit.
That's
you said
okay.
Something a little bit earlier. I want to jump back into the talk. But you said something a little bit earlier that I kind of want to touch on a bit, which is when a lot of women who have a career or have come from a career that they themselves love and they're passionate about, and they become a mom, and career life kind of ends and they enter mom world. I'm really curious because just recently my wife, Vanessa, who ran the fruit shop in Miramar, she became a mom and she's now a full-time mom. And I'm not a full-time dad, but I'm a half-time dad now.
Yeah.
And I kind of reached a point where I found when I put most of my week into parenting as an artist, I sort of started feeling a little bit depressed.
Yes.
That whole bipolar artist thing where if you're not creating, you're unhappy.
Yes.
I want to sort of dig into this a little bit because I know a lot of parents, especially moms, maybe could relate with this or experience this. Can you talk a little bit about the decision that made you switch into wanting to do the talk? Do you remember what kind of kicked that off?
I was probably in quite an unusual environment when that was going on. Like if we'd stayed in Wellington, and I probably would have been surrounded by, as you do when you become a new mum, as other mums. And I mean, it's a creative process trying to figure out how to keep a baby alive initially.
Yeah.
And that's what you need, and what you want around you is other mums and sharing stuff. And so I think if we'd stayed in Wellington, it might not have been so pronounced for me. And I probably would have, you know, there's other parts of your life which can tick along. But I think because we were there.
Because just to paint the picture, you guys were in Mendocino County.
Oh, so we were in Mendocino.
You guys were in the middle of the woods.
Yes.
In the middle of remote California.
Yeah.
Right?
So, yes. Yeah, yeah. We were.
You guys were. Yeah.
The driveway was half an hour through the trees.
Yeah.
And so I think what made it more pronounced is that I was surrounded by people who were in there just at the start of their careers. You know, they were, it's like Camp America.
Yeah.
They were just starting off, and they were all a something. You were a ropes instructor, or you worked in arts and craft, or you were a swim instructor, or you had a thing that you did that was separate to who you were. And when I was introduced to all of them as, oh, who are you? I'm the mother. So it was probably, I think it was even more pronounced for me in that particular scenario of that I felt like that. But to go back to what you're saying before about, I think it really is, whether you're an artist, whether you call yourself an artist or not, having a creative outlet when you're a parent is so important. It's more important than having a way of making money sometimes, I think. It's just having something that pulls you back to the you that you are that's not a parent. So for me, I've always had, so writing's always been that. You know, I mean, I did have that in the, I mean, I have it anywhere as long as I've got my laptop. And my partner bought me a little one that I could write on when we were in the forest, because he knows that as well. I go a little bit nuts if I haven't written for a while, but I think it's actually just a form of expressing. So it doesn't really matter what it is, but I think it's really important for new parents, and especially whichever one it is who's spending time around the children, is that they suck a lot of creativity and life out of you.
Yeah.
And so you to inject some of that back in again, if you've got a small creative outlet yourself, I mean, it could be yodeling. It doesn't matter what it is, but it's something that brings you back to, I'm many things and a parent is one of them, rather than it's the only thing. It's just as a way to stay sane with it.
So
you can lose yourself in it. Yeah, which you understand too.
Definitely. So I do want to jump back into the talk.
Okay.
That is something that I definitely do want to get to. But you did sort of bring up that you had your partner end up getting you a laptop and you sort of started writing again. If we could just shift gears back to writing just for a second. I'm really curious because you always hear this term writer's block. What comes to mind when people talk about that? Is that something?
Constipation?
Constipation, yeah.
I think that there's, like anything, there's techniques and tools and tricks, and especially if someone's commissioned you to write something, so you're writing as a job rather than you're just having a little fiddle around with words for your own pleasure, then there's ways to find tricks to get around, especially if you've only got a few hours, rather than think that there's a thing called writer's block. There's some days where it feels easier and there's some days where it doesn't feel so easy. But I find whenever it comes to writing something commissioned, you know, it's a pay job, whether it's a copywriting job or I'm writing an article, that my trick, and I find I very rarely have writer's block if I do this trick, is I start with long form. I start to write it out by hand. So I have in my head what I think the article's going to be. And it's taken me a while to figure out this process. Force myself to write the whole thing, write the whole flow, not word by word, but just sort of loose thoughts out.
As a stream of consciousness, like verbal diarrhea on paper.
On paper.
Got it.
So I think it's going to start with that snappy thing, and then I'm going to do that and that and that. And then I'll get a coloured pen out and I'll have little ones and arrows and different, and I'll visually see it. And I'll get to the end and then I have this kind of sense like, oh, I've already written it. I haven't. But I've purged out the sense or flow, and then it's so much faster when I then go back and I type it up. And because what I used to do is I used to start with the first paragraph.
And you just stare at the blinking cursor.
And you just try and keep making it great all the time because you want the first paragraph to be great. Yeah. So you get totally sidetracked. It's actually better just to write something rubbishy in the first paragraph, but get the, because you're taking someone on a, picking them up somewhere and dropping them off somewhere else, hopefully, if you've interviewed someone or you're writing about a subject or, so actually get that done. And then there'll be days when you feel more creative about that first paragraph than other days. There's this great, what's her name? This poet, Rose, I can't think of her last name now. It's an American poet that talks about the creative process. She'd be in her 80s or 90s now, and she used to talk about before the flow was even a term, she used to say that she grew up in the Missouri, I think, and that when she was young, a poem would sometimes come thundering down over the hills towards her. She might be outside. Have I told you about this woman before? I feel like I have. So she might be outside working with her parents on the land, and she could feel this poem come. She could just feel it kind of vibrating and come thundering towards her, and she would run inside and grab a pen and get the poem down as she just sort of would feel it thundering through her and moving on.
Of course, because if you don't, it'll come and go.
Yeah. And she said a couple of times she could feel the poem kind of snatching, going past her, and she grabbed it by the tail and pulled it in, and she wrote it, would come out backwards, she'd write down a poem and it would come out the other way around. And I probably, if I'd heard that 15 years ago, I would have laughed and said, oh, that's ridiculous. But I have, and I'm not a poet, but I have since felt moments when an idea hits you, and it could be an idea about something that's happened to you, but you suddenly have this uncontrollable urge that you've got to write about it. Sometimes I'll have it at 5 in the morning, or sometimes I'll have it, you know, I've dropped my kids off on the bus and I'm meant to be going to work, and it's only there for a little period of time. It's similar to the poet running in, and you don't have to do much with it. You just have to get down the sort of the basis of the gist or the heart of it. And I can feel quite sad if I miss that moment, and then I get busy and then it's gone.
Do you find that there's ways in which you can create that situation to happen? Either through, I don't know, if you're taking a hot shower or if you're meditating, or if you're, you know, are there sort of tricks that you found to, that's what flow state is, right?
It is.
Have you found tricks of getting into flow state?
Definitely doing something physical beforehand. So you can have an idea rummaging around, and then I go for a walk down to Piha and let the weather blow me about, and it just jumbles everything up, and you come out with a bit of clarity, and or maybe you just feel part of a bigger world, and you're less stuck in your own little head with worried about, oh, I've got to pick up that thing from the dry cleaners and I've got to figure out what happened. You know, you get, it helps remove yourself from the mundane part of life and into bigger ideas. Yeah. That definitely works. Sometimes I get it when something really emotional has happened. So I've tapped into a feeling that is, it might be a little bit uncomfortable, the feeling. It could be a sense of, I feel like, oh, maybe a sense of rejection from one of my kids. They've done something, or, you know, they're in a constant state of loving you, pushing you away, loving you, pushing you away. I mean, that's part of them growing up. I've found that sometimes I might get quite emotional about it, and then I'll be really surprised what comes out when I'm writing. And if I let myself cry when I'm writing, if I'm writing about something really, I did it recently with an interview about someone where I went back and watched a whole lot of videos about them, and I was crying when I was watching. It was a really, really sad story. And then I found, wow, I'm can write about this with a lot more heart.
Wow. What was it about the story that made you cry?
The one I was just doing recently. She was a burn victim. She'd been burnt 65% of her body, brutal, down to the bone. She wore like a balaclava mask for 2 years. It was so touching watching the story of how she survived. That's what made me cry. It was just really, it was well documented.
Yeah.
So I definitely know that. And it's the opposite of how, when I first started writing, how I wanted to write. I wanted to be, you know, literary and erudite. And, you know, I always would want to appear like I knew what I was talking about on the page. And I'm not a trained journalist, and I've had to give up that, or my ego's had to give that up recently, and sort of admit that the stuff that people seem to like more than I write is when I'm being myself and I'm being upfront about something, or admitting that I don't know something or I don't understand it and I'm trying to find out more. The more human and the more I reveal how I'm the opposite of how I'd like to paint myself as sort of an educated English major. Yeah. I'm not. I was a science and maths girl. I school C English was my worst subject. So I think I probably have a little shadow following me around, is that I'm not really a writer. I'm not a trained journalist. I'm not really a proper writer. So I've always thought at some point I'll get to a stage where I'm like a proper grown-up writer, and people will read my stuff and know that I've studied enough, or I've read enough books, but that's not the stuff that people like that I write. So,
speaking of writing, the last time we spoke, you were telling me about a book that you're working on. May I ask what about the book?
Yeah, you can ask them.
How's the process of writing a book?
Well, I've stopped it for now because the process was long, and every time I dived into it, it's a story that I've tried to let go of numerous times. I've tried to shake it off. I've tried to put it in a bottom drawer. I've tried to tell it, go away story, I've had enough of you. And it keeps coming back, and every time it comes back, I get filled with excitement again about writing it. And I've done it draft after draft. And I think what I've been doing, back to what I was saying before about what I do with a short story, is I'll figure out the whole flow by hand. What I've been doing every single time is I've been working really hard on the first paragraph, or I've been working really hard on the first third of it. And so I've written the whole thing a few different times, and I've done various different long endings and short endings, and my husband can't stand it every time I talk. He's like, oh, that book, you know, when are you going to stop? And every time I've sent it out, I'll get encouraging, but not, oh, it's there yet. It's like, you've got something, but it's not quite there.
So these are notes from your publisher?
Yeah, they're from, you know, at one stage I won a Twitter contest of send your idea for your book out in a tweet, and I had an agent in the States that would review the first three chapters, and then they reviewed the first 100 pages. So I get interest when I try and describe it in a line or a one page. And so I had some advice to put it away a year ago, and it's been really good to put it away. And I think when I come at it again, I need to come at it not from the long, arduous, oh, I've got to start down and start with chapter one and word number one, and here I go working my way up to 80,000 words again is come at it from a different way where it feels fresh and fun. And I've got a couple of writers friends I've talked to about recently, and one friend who's in Portland said to me, why don't you, okay, we'll start at the end next time, and rather than start on your laptop, why don't you get a microphone and start talking into a microphone and start recording, just do it in a different way, because I've had enough time from it, I'm quite clear now what I think it should be, but it's, I'm trying not to rush the process as well, and let it, it's just taking as long as it's taking to cook. It's a slow burner, this one. Yeah, so I have to let that be okay.
Is this the, I guess, the longest project that you've worked on?
Yes. Yeah, it is.
Do you ever find that when you're working on sort of these long projects that it's hard to set like a delivery date? Or have you set delivery dates in the past?
Yes, I have. And they're great to have a delivery date.
Yeah.
So that it's been, like, I've got to send it off to this person by this date or by August the 5th.
Yeah.
I have to have done that. Or when we're in the forest, I would have windows of time when I could do it. Okay, I'm going to work for a month. I'm going to get up 5 o'clock every morning before the kids get up and have that. So I've had, you've got to do that. You have to put a deadline on it. And also you can't just slog away at it all year.
Yeah.
It's much better to do a burst of it, of intense time, and then give yourself a break and don't think about it and put it down and let it. I mean, I was feeling a little, not embarrassed, but probably a little shy about how long it had been taking me, until lately I've been listening to a podcast from Mary Carr, who has written, because mine's a memoir of that period in time in Zambia, and she's written 3 best-selling memoirs, and she's teaches memoir. Listening to her, she said, no one in their sane mind goes down this path. Like, surely you'd start with a fiction story. Like and she described the process of when a story has got you, and it's some part of your own story that you have to share, and it won't let you go. She said it's the most painful process to go through, because you can't. The only thing that's going to make it better is the closer you get to the truth, and the closer you get to the truth, the harder it is to dig into and talk about. And it's a long process. And she said most people, you need to be at least 8 to 10 years away from the time that you're talking about to be able to even have any perspective on it.
Oh, wow.
And that it's not insane for it to take 15 or 20 years. And when I heard that, I thought, oh, that's great.
And this is talking particularly about a memoir.
Just memoir. That's what she studied for years. And I really like her, because she wanted to be a poet. She wanted to be, and she said the last thing I wanted to be was be a memoirist, because for a long time it's considered the lowest form of literature.
Yeah.
Oh, they're just having a little chat about themselves. They want to talk, you know, it's sort of seen as quite narcissistic. So she's basically confirmed I'm not, it's okay that I have the story that has been chasing me.
Yeah.
And it's okay that it's not ready yet.
And is there any information about this book online, or is it completely in, I guess, stealth mode?
Yeah, it's all hidden in my
laptop.
It's all hidden.
Yeah.
I'll give you the one line though.
Yeah, I'd
like.
Love to hear it.
What was the tweet that won that agent competition? Was bulimic gets diet pills in famine afflicted Zambia was the I think was the tweet that I put out, which was that's a whole lot going into one line.
But what that says is I want to know more.
Yeah. I mean, they went, oh, that sounds a bit messed up. So yeah, that was the tweet that won that. So the line I often had put on the synopsis is the story of the bulimic that goes to Zambia to try and save hungry people and totally fails.
Wow. So bulimia. Is it okay to just jump straight into that?
Yeah.
So that's been a chapter in your life.
That was a chapter. Yeah.
Without, I guess, getting...
Did you know that? Yeah.
I did know it.
You did know,
but I've never really asked you questions about it.
You can ask me. There's a lot of vomiting.
Oh. Because I've never sort of dug into, I guess, the psychology that leads to the physical act.
Yeah.
For you, what was the reasoning for the bulimia?
Ah, so this is... It's actually... the answer ends up leading back round to why I do the talks in a sort of roundabout way, because there's a few different things that can lead to it. And it's either external or internal, and it's family, it's genes, it's your own physiology. There's about six things that can lead to it. But the one way to understand, I went to this talk recently, this woman I call the godmother of eating disorders, this woman called Cynthia Burlick, who's set up different clinics around the world, and she's studied it. And she tries to dispel myths around eating disorders, because they're such a, especially for parents, it's such an unknown, scary thing, as they seem to just rear up out of nowhere and then completely take over, or they can take over. And so she said, if you took a normal classroom of children and you, because there's a lot of work now going into an eating disorder gene, is if you put, let's say, okay, let's say 10 children and you put them on a diet, all of them on a diet for a week, they've never been on a diet before. At the end of the week, one child will have anorexia. There'll be between two and three that will either have a mix, or they will develop, sorry, they won't just have it straight away, but they will go down that path of developing it. Between two and three will go down the path of either some kind of binge eating, bulimia, which is eating, restricting, purging it in some form, and then the others will be fine. They'll just go back to their normal life again. So, and then out of that, it's just, then you have the million different circumstances as to what can create it and not create it. So for me, it started with so clearly not feeling like my body fitted in with all the other bodies, and trying to control it with a diet initially. So it can often start off that way based on your environment or your family, or whether dieting is a suggested way to try and control your body, which often, you know, often it is. And so it can start off being about what feels like it's about the food and trying to control your body shape, or try and get it to a shape that you think is more acceptable or would be more likeable. I unfortunately got feedback when I was 12 I was just a bit lumpy and a bit bigger than the other girls. I wasn't, as a child, I wasn't sort of a skinny little sporty kid. And I didn't get teased a lot, but I do remember when I was about 11, I had a boyfriend who watched me do the high jump and then dumped me after, and said I was like a big cow trying to do, you know. And I imagine I was probably quite uncoordinated. I might have dumped me when I watched myself do the high jump. Anyway, so he broke up with me, which is fine. Like, that just happens all the time. You go out with people and they break up with you. But then I shifted schools, and we were living half an hour away from our school, and I had to cycle to school, and I suddenly just lost a whole lot of weight, and I became the same size as all the other girls. And then my grandmother died, and we went back to the old school for a day, because we'd shifted to towns. And when I went back to the old school, I suddenly had so much attention from everyone, including the guy that had dumped me from the high jump, who was like, I want to go out with you for a day. And, you know, I was just visiting. And so sadly for me, I got all this feedback on this one day, which is, oh, now you're acceptable because you're the same weight as the rest of us. And actually, you're even more than acceptable. You're great. We want to hang out with you. Come to my place. You know, so that was a dangerous equation for me, is I need to somehow, I don't have a body like everyone else's, and I need to try and manage it, because I'll have more friends and I'll get a boyfriend. And so it starts off at this really, and it's such a tender age to be learning those things. It's sort of 12, and it's not an age you want to be learning those things. You want to be still focused on maths and space and writing stories and having fun with your friends. But then what it quickly becomes, and I will happily tell this to any parents, is that it becomes really addictive. So it becomes a very dark addiction. It's, I wouldn't put it up there with heroin, but it's can be quite a devastating addiction that is secretive. You're lying. You'll steal food if you need to. It's your behaviors become all about the secretive, shameful behavior that you do, that ends up becoming a It's like it becomes a way to control your emotions, actually, rather than your physicalness. So after a while, that disappears and it becomes like a packet of cigarettes or a bottle of vodka, where it becomes like a crutch. So something terrible happens, you have a big fight at work, or you don't get a promotion, or, and then that becomes your secret thing. Okay, screw the world. I'm going to go and get 2 tubs of ice cream. And so, I mean, we often do that in a, you know, we might go, right, I'm going to have a cocktail and I'm going to eat pizza. But a bulimic will do it in a crazy way. And you eat a whole bunch of food, and then you have to bring it all up again, because that's what you've trained yourself to think that you need to do. And in the process of doing that, you've lost hours, and then you've completely forgotten what it was that you were originally upset about. And then by the time you can be in the bathroom for an hour, and by the time you brought it all up again, you feel purged and kind of on a weird sort of high, like, oh, I'm out the other side of that now. And then you ignore whatever the problem was. You never address it. You never confront what was facing you. And then you have the shame that you did that secret dirty thing again. And it builds like that. So that's for bulimics that get it bad, that's what makes it so awful, is you'll be the person leaving the party. You'll be the person that's lying to your boyfriend. You've gone out on a date and then you're like, no, I don't want to see you tonight. And you're quite aloof often. It's hard, you won't let people get close to you, because if they get close, so it is quite, it's on the spectrum of addiction and, what's the other one? Melancholy.
So
you can edit some of that out if you
want. No, absolutely not. I'm learning about it for the first time, really.
Right.
So this is actually quite amazing for me to hear it from someone who's lived through it. How did you sort of dig yourself out of that world? Did you talk about it with somebody, or?
Yeah, slowly, very slowly. It's a very, I mean, I worked in advertising. You know, we used to sit around and make jokes about bulimics and anorexic models, you know, when we were casting for ads and things. Yeah. So I never talked about dieting. I never talked about my body. I never revealed any of that, even though people possibly could see that there was something wrong. So I knew how, it's like the uncoolest addiction you could have in the world. You can slash, you know, you can be a cutter, you can smoke pee, you can smoke, you know, in terms of addictions, it's kind of the most shameful, because it's something icky, and it's food, which is something that we all enjoy. And so it was really hard for me to talk about it. And I did initially tell one friend, and she was fantastic. She was the right person to tell. And she was, okay, so what should we do? You know, should we try and get some help? And, oh, okay, but I don't want to. She said, all right, shall I ring them? So she rang the Eating Disorders Association in Wellington. And this is going to sound really awful, but the counsellor that I was put in front of was a really, really very, very, very large person. She was really big. And so I instantly couldn't listen to anything. So I just kept looking at her going, wow, you're my biggest fear, is it? If I stop doing this, I'm going to be like you. And so I went once to her, and I put the bulimic in front of anyone else. albino, you know, a person with no legs, anything else. Just that was too confronting for me. But she said one thing which was helpful. She said, start keeping a diary or a journal. So that's what I did. I used to have it in code so that if my husband ever found it, he wouldn't know what it was. And I gave her a name, Gertrude. And so I found it easier to say, you know, Gertrude, I saw Gertrude tonight. And then I just started. That's how I figured out that it was emotional. Actually, before then, it would just feel like, oh, God, that thing happened again. But similar to if you've accidentally had a gigantic night and you drank so much that you don't remember, but usually that's fun. It's similar to that where I'm not quite sure where that came from, but it just blasted in and took over and I lost some time. And so, yeah, I would start to record what was going on beforehand, and then I was able to start to see a pattern. Okay, this has now become my, it's my bottle of vodka.
So putting it out on paper.
That I could just start to see patterns. And then I would set myself small challenges. I really didn't want it when I turned 30 because I started when I was 19. So then I had it, like I've had this on and off, but pretty steady throughout my 20s. And so that was a goal for me, was I didn't want it to be with me going into my 30s. And so then I would just set small goals for myself. At one stage, I was like, okay, rather than never do it, you can do it on a Monday night, like bad TV night. It's okay, just because quite often I'd stay at work as well. So then I would do steps like that rather than, okay, no, it's fine. You don't have to say never. It's similar to how you deal with an addict. And slowly wean myself off. And then I was about 3 months shy of turning 30 was the last entry I had in my, I had a Wallace and Gromit book because it rhymed with vomit. Notebook.
So was 30 a goal that you'd set?
Yeah, 30 was a goal.
And what motivated that goal?
I think just because it had been all through my 20s, I just felt like I needed, I quite like symmetry with numbers, and okay, that was the bulimic decade. Yeah. I need a new title for the next decade. So it's just how I work quite well with. I knew that I'd be, if I could get to 30 and I felt like I'd confidently stopped, then I could charge into the decade that way.
Wow. And thank you so much for sharing that.
It's okay.
That was amazing to hear that. Being vulnerable is definitely something that I myself am struggling with and I'm trying to work on. I'm trying to get better at. So it's inspiring to hear someone who's willing to take off all of their armor like that and share such a personal story. So thank you.
It's okay. I think I make jokes about it because I feel a little uncomfortable revealing it, but I also don't care anymore if people know.
Yeah.
I care more if people, I feel like it's one aspect of me, but it doesn't define me anymore.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does.
Yeah.
So can you talk about, you mentioned earlier, that sort of tied into your talk.
Oh, it does.
Yeah, so can we sort of move back into the talk and sort of how that applied to the talk?
So, you know what I was saying before about the 10 people, the 10 kids in the room, and the one's going to get anorexia and the three are going to get a binge eating. So but then of those, there's sort of, and that will be a mix of physiological and genetic disposition. So if your parents have had an eating disorder, you're more likely to get one. But there's six things that contribute towards getting one, and every person is different and it varies. And so one of the aspects is media and messages that you see in the media and messages that tell you in some form that however you are is not right and that you should therefore try and change it. So that's probably my personal motivation for doing the talks. It's not that everyone's going to get an eating disorder, because they're not, like there's so many people that don't, but I see a lot of people really struggling with how they look, and every single one of us is very different with how we look, and we're all completely unique. And so it seems like a great injustice is that we have shown all around us images of same, same, same. This is kind of an idealized way that we should look. And all it ends up doing is making you feel a little bit inadequate. So my whole idea for the talks, and I was thinking of myself when I was, if I could have known back then that whatever I had in my mind that I used to see in Mum's Easy Buy catalogues that had Rachel Hunter, the supermodel in them, or whatever limited, and I was very, very limited what I was exposed to, that was a picture that was being painted to sell products. And that was constructed. It's constructed in the same way that a film's constructed. And so it's fine to admire it, it's fine to look at it, but just see through it. So that's part of my motivation for Pretty Smart, is that, and I would have thought, now we all know what Photoshop is and we've been talking about this subject for a long time, that people, that generation below me would be more savvy about this, and that, you know, we've been talking, we're up to our fourth wave of feminism and we've been telling girls they can do anything for quite a while, and, you know, we've got a whole lot of energy has gone into helping facilitate women feel like they've got all the options open to them. Yet still there's between 60 and 70% of high school girls, they'll hit a certain age where they're more concerned about how they look than how they're doing in maths or sports. Like it hasn't got better. It's actually got worse. And we're not helping ourselves with, like, social media feeds are making it worse. And then also what's happened is we have this globalization with advertising. So there's one type of beautiful that we now see everywhere. So, and I show the girls this in the talk, because I've got this big billboard that I pull up in Thailand. I've got one in Thailand and one in India, where it's advertising a face whitening cream, you know, with one half of the face that's all made up sort of to be more beautiful and whiter, and then the other half that's darker, and, you know, buy this cream to be whatever the lines are on it. This is one thing that I found so sad to see when I was in Africa, was in the supermarket aisles, just past the toothbrushes and the toothpaste, is there's really full-on acidic whitening moisturizing cream for the girls that's full body and face, that's toxic cream that they're putting on, because they're now getting messages that they want to look like Beyonce rather than their mother, who's lighter. So, and the industry is, more money goes into it, the beauty industry, than education. It's a really powerful industry. So that's part of my motivation for the talk, is just to say to these girls, just look through it, right? It's you can be going to the movies, walking past that pharmacy, look at those same images of bright red juicy lips that we see. I'm not saying don't put on lipstick. It's not a judgment of what you do to make yourself feel good. I'm just saying, look at that and go, there it is again. The same big juicy lips, the same slightly parted expression. There's that same skin again. There's the faces we see that never have any freckles or moles, or everyone's always got two legs, and you never see the guy with the ginger hair, or you never see the hair lip. But, and just see through it all, kind of, you know, point it out. And, I mean, studies have been done that says if you teach teens to see through what they're seeing in the media and images, what they're seeing through, then they're less likely to be affected by them. So that's the only thing I'm able to influence. You know, I'm not a therapist. I don't feel equipped to help teens in that way. I can't help with the other five factors that might affect them, but that's one area. And plus I've been in studios in advertising where we have, the designer has been photoshopping the legs of the model only because it was cold on the day of the shoot, and she had, you know how some skin goes sort of purple and blotchy when it's cold, and the skin on her thigh is purple and blotchy, and it's detracting from the phone that she's selling. So I mean, I get it. I've seen it. Everything is touched up.
I'm very aware of this because I was in the fashion photography industry for many years, and a lot of the campaigns I worked on, photos that would end up in magazines, I was requested to make this hand shorter and make this leg longer and get rid of these bags under the eyes. And these are the notes that I got as the photographer / touch-up artist. And every time I would get those requests, and I would be in Photoshop with the clone tool painting these things out, in the pit of my stomach and my heart, it always felt wrong.
Did it?
Yeah.
I've wondered that.
Because you're essentially a plastic surgeon.
Yeah.
A digital plastic surgeon, right? Yes. You're changing the way in which this person looks in real life.
Yes.
And it seems like there's this huge offset where the eyeballs that look at images and media and consumers of media almost expect that standard of beauty.
Yes, they do.
And then there's you on this side that's fighting that, right? I've heard of some magazines where they've sort of made the commitment, like no Photoshop in our magazine. And it seems like that's sort of a good place to start, right? At the publication level.
Yeah.
But in terms of sort of tackling the industry as a whole, do you think there's a way in which you can sort of influence the industry?
I don't know. I mean, the interesting thing is there's some magazines that have gone, okay, we're not going to Photoshop. We're going to have someone completely natural and older on the front, on the cover of our magazine, and they might try that and not as many copies are bought. And then they'll go, oh, we've got to go back to the glossy, shiny fantasy. You know, there's examples like that. There's examples in the completely opposite direction. The woman I was telling you about before that was burnt to, her name's Turea Pitt. She's an Australian. She's burnt to 65% of her body, all over her face as well. She's completely unrecognisable from what she was like pre-burn to post. She was on the cover of Australian Women's Weekly a couple of years ago, and it was the most, you know, widely sold issue of the entire year. So, I mean, it's brave. It's brave to make those decisions, to step against the grain. I mean, I don't think that there's one big evil mastermind. There's not a Jabba the Hutt, who's going screw up more people. So, it's like anything. There'll be a tipping point, and there's already some tipping. I mean, you can look at a lot of brands now that were, there's one thing I show in the talk actually, is I show Target, right, in the States. They had online, so this is the thing I explained to the girls as well, is it's not just when you're out in the street on your social media feed, is you could be buying a new pair of togs online, and what you're looking at there, you could think of it as a mannequin, rather than, even though it might look like it's real legs. And then I show them, there was a flew around the internet a few years ago, someone had photoshopped out, there was a chunk taken out of the thigh gap between, they were selling bikini bottoms, but they'd gone right up into the crutch of the, so this kind of, it was like a bite had been taken out, and you could see where how it had been chopped out. Right. So you could instantly see, yeah, they were making a wider gap between the legs, but then they made a mistake and bit into her bum. And that flew around going, oh, Target even does this. They're even creating this kind of idolized super skinny legs on the, when you're trying to sell bikini bottoms online. And they did a campaign last year that at least started to see some different shapes and sizes and colors. And so there's definitely a movement and there's awareness of it. But I think it's bigger than just marketing and advertising.
And social media is a double-edged sword, because social media does contribute to the problem, but it also helps combat it, because there'll be individuals who are body image positive and Instagram account is all about the anti of that. And it'll just be photos of my face without makeup, the rolls on my stomach, all the wrinkles on my body. And it seems like there's a huge sort of shift in terms of those individuals are being respected more on social media now.
Yes, they are. And they're amazing, those ones. There is, you will still get more young girls though following a Kardashian than those girls. You'll get people who've are more aware of the subject. And I heard this statistic the other day that in 80% of countries, Facetune is one of the most popular apps.
Facetune. What's Facetune?
So it means you can doctor a photo really easily, and so it's like Photoshop for, but it's really Photoshop for social media, and you can. So if you look at, and I show the girls this as well in the talk. So if you look at side by side, the difference will be just a photo of, you know, a normal photo, and then one where. Are my cheeks a bit red at the moment? because I get a bit hot when I'm talking. So, okay, so if there's one of me and my cheeks are a bit red, the next one will be they've all just been smoothed out like I've had, you know, makeup put on me. Or there'll be one of, you can, if you've got quite a round face, you can suck it in a bit and give yourself more cheekbones, because the photo still looks, it doesn't look polished at all, it still looks like a snap. And it just happened recently to me, and I talked to the girls about this as well, okay, and people can see through this if you start to do it. And I met this, I was getting my legs waxed actually, and I met this woman who was, you know, I was talking to this woman who was waxing my legs, and she was telling me how she was a body positive role model, and that she had this Instagram feed, and I was telling her about what I was like, great. And she said, yeah, go and check out my feed. And I put in the handle, and there was quite a few selfies of her face, and I kept thinking, oh, hold on, have I written it down wrong? And then I sort of, my heart sank. I was like, wow, it looks like she's using Facetune, because the shape of her face was very different to the shape of the face of the woman that I was talking to. And in all the selfies that she had, she had quite a sucked in face and cheekbones, and I felt so disappointed and sad. So I try and explain that to the girls as well, is that people, just like people can see through advertising, they can see through this if you start to use it. And it ends up, it doesn't make you feel good. It's going to end up making you feel a bit icky, and people might feel like maybe they don't know you as well, or they can't trust you to be you, and why can't you be yourself? And also try and take the focus off. Social media should not be a chance. You already, as a teenager, you feel like the whole world's watching you anyway, and it is at school. Don't have social media as another whole world where it's watching you. Then you're just constantly watching, or you watched at home, and try and turn it around where it should be your eyes out to the world, rather than it's another place to have eyes on you. So yeah. I go, yes, you'll go through a selfie stage. We all go through a selfie stage. But at some point, it's way more interesting to turn it around and share what you're experiencing in your reality out.
Yeah. So this talk.
Oh, yeah, the talk.
Tell me about how it's evolved and where it's going now.
I do them, I'm averaging maybe one a month at this stage. I mean, I might do two in a month, or I'm going to do two in one day next week. But it's, and then at the end of last year, I was doing one every week, because the term four tends to be something that schools book more in. So they're just, and I'm just letting them build. I'll send out to schools a little email, and I've just, every time I do one, I've got more references and references. So it's just building slowly. And now I'm finding schools are going, you know, I first started and they'd get 50 girls in, and so now they're going, if it's an intermediate school, let's get all year 7, year 8 in together. I do them all in one hit. We get in the hall. And
does this apply to boys and girls?
No, it's only girls at this stage. And the main reason why there's two reasons why it's girls at this stage. One is, because I show, it's called a talk, but I show so much stuff, because they're 11 and 12, 10, 11, 12 year olds. You need to keep them engaged. So I ask them some questions, and then I show, talk, show stuff. Yeah. And most of the material I've got is females, and the examples I've got, and everything that backs up what I'm talking about. And I haven't been able to find enough to be able to, because you kind of got to prove what you're talking about and back it up.
You use data to make your points.
Or videos as well, live examples and images. And so there's less to show boys. So that's one not very good reason, because if I spent some more energy on it, I could probably figure that out. And I'd like to at some point.
But this problem does apply also to boys.
It totally applies to boys. And it's getting a lot worse for boys as well. Yeah. But there's something, even if I did do boys, I might still do them all separately, because there ends up being some kind of quite an intimate feeling somehow towards the end. Because I will say to the girls, you as a female will get judged by how you look, and it comes at you It can come at you from family members. It can come at you in job. You know, it comes at you from quite a few different places. And you've got to be kind to yourself inside your own head and be good with how you look, because you can't change it. Right? You've got to, rather than have another enemy, have a friend on the inside who's kind to yourself about how you look. But it does actually, like, yes, it affects boys, but girls get it so much more.
Yeah.
We just do. We just get judged so much more by how we look,
yeah.
Whether we're prime minister or we are a mother or a daughter or a, we just, there's a lot more eyes on women. One of the stats that the other thing I do is I've written about it for various magazines in the industry, and I write a story recently. A study was done last year that had in advertising, there was only 3% of ads to show a woman as intelligent.
Wow, that's shocking.
2% in managerial roles and 1% is funny. These are global stats though. New Zealand will be skewed slightly differently. And it was so shocking. It came out of Cannes, this. And so I write about stuff like that going, what are we doing in the ads, women? You know, we have, and I can, it's so easy for me to find examples where I put side by side Billabong. The photo for the guy for Billabong is he's, for the shorts, for the swimwear, he's on a wakeboard and he's high up in the air and you can hardly even see the shorts and it's action. And then the girl, she's posing like a jellyfish has stung her on the beach, and it's still everywhere. Often how we compare all the time is we still compare a lot more. We still do a lot more judging on, well, how do you look for a female than we do for males.
Yeah.
So it's definitely a talk there for boys, but there's something in the, I kind of feel like an auntie a bit when I'm talking to the girls at the end going, there's going to be this stuff, like, have your one line ready when someone says something like that, or if you've got
something
different about
you. Can you give us an example of that?
Of
that particular one line example?
Oh, the one line. So, oh, well, I tell them, depending on how much time I've got, I tell them a story about, and I'll usually single out a girl in the group who might be Pacific Island, who's, I'll tell them about Selena Tusitala-Marsh, who's the current poet laureate in New Zealand, who's got magnificent hair. Really, really, really big hair. And she's got, it's kind of Morticia Adams, it's dark, and then she's got a silver streak there. And I mean, she performed in Westminster Abbey in front of the Queen last year, and she had her hair out, and she's magnificent, and it's now part of her stage presence. But she, when I interviewed her last year, she said she used to hate her hair when she was at high school, like because it never behaved like the other girls' hair. It was always bigger and bushier, and she said, you know, now her line is, there's just more of me to love with this hair. And she said, I wish I could have gone back and said that to myself. You know, there's more of me to admire. You just have to own it, whatever it is. If you've got red hair, it's like, yeah, I've got fire on top of my head. What have you got? Dirt. Yeah. You know, like, just acknowledge, and I mean, we don't necessarily have to be mean back, but just try and own your own stuff.
Yeah, love your differences.
Yeah. And then I also get them to, their homework is to think about three things they like about their own physicalness, because I talk about towards the end of the talk that beauty should be a feeling more than anything. It's far more powerful as a feeling. Are you feeling it from the inside? Do you feel it? It should be, you know, kind is beautiful. Doing something kind, or having a moment, or if you think of someone's laughing or they're telling a joke, how beautiful that is. Like, how we're all so much more than just a static photo of ourselves. And or you jump off a high rock into a freezing cold river. I do this at Piha, at this place called The Coffin, which is really scary because it's shaped like a coffin. And anyway, whenever I do it, I come out and I feel my most beautiful, because I was a little bit scared and I pushed myself to do something, and the cold water makes my skin feel alive. And, you know, I'm actually just a drowned rat when I come out, but in terms of a feeling, I feel really strong. So I say to them, you just arm yourself with, you've got stuff inside your own head that you're okay with. You don't have to love everything about yourself. And so I get them to do that. You know, I want you to write down three things that you like about. Can be your ears. It doesn't matter what it is. It can be your ears, can be your toes, can be your nose. But those are your things, and you put it in your back pocket, and they are yours, and no one else has them. And you own those things. Rather than go down the path of, they put up a slide that, you know, there's like 80% of people don't like what they see in the mirror, which is a really horribly sad statistic. And I'd say that's worse than what it was 30 years ago. So I was, and I put that up in sort of an image with, my nose is too big and my freckles are too close together, and, you know, just the thoughts that we can have. And I'll explain to them, saying, if this is how you're starting your day every day in the mirror by telling yourself things like that, it becomes, after a while, like having a best friend, but a really mean best friend who sits in the corner of the bathroom every day and tells you those things every day, where you start to believe them. And you start to think that they're telling you the truth. So that's how your sort of subconscious will take it on. And that's, you tell yourself that every day, then you're starting off the day with, you know, I'm not okay. I don't look okay. I'm not okay. So we do a bit of work around trying to reverse that with, just have your three things that you feel okay about.
Yeah. And if people want to find out more about this talk, where should they go?
I have it online. I've got a Facebook page.
Where should they go online?
At the moment, if you just Google "pretty smart" in my name, it will come up.
And what's your name? How do you spell your name?
Oh, Angela Barnett, Barnett.
So pretty smart, Angela Barnett.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've got an Instagram page that is not actually about the talks, but I just repost photos of teens who I think are using social media well. So it's just called Pretty Smart Teens. And I just search through and find, it's just promoting good examples of people using social media well, which is interesting stuff. And rather than always eyes on them, eyes out.
Yeah. And then where should they go to find you on Facebook?
So it's Pretty Smart Teens as well on Facebook.
Yep. Just search that.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's a school that's interested in having you talk,
yeah,
is your schedule open?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And so is the best way for them to reach you on social, email you?
Yeah, yeah.
What's your email?
Do you want me to
give it out on this podcast? Maybe that's not a good idea.
Oh, no. It's just prettysmartteens@gmail.com.
Prettysmartteens@gmail.com.
Yeah.
Great.
But there's just one T. So pretty smart. And then teens would be, if you spout that out in full, it would be pretty smart teens.
Got it.
Brilliant. Does that make sense?
That totally makes sense. We've gone for an hour and 24 minutes.
Oh, you're kidding.
And I'm glad we did, because we touched on a lot of important things, I think. And I think this is a good place to sort of wrap up our conversation.
Yeah, I think it is. I didn't realize we'd gone on for so long.
No,
well, I went on for quite a long time.
I could have gone on for a lot longer, because I love hearing your stories and I love hearing about what you're doing. And I think it's really important. There's not many things that people are doing that have great positive long-term effects on society for the better. And I think this is definitely one of those things. So I take my hat off to you.
Thank you for creating
this pretty smart movement. And I want to thank you for coming on the podcast and sharing your stories with everyone who's listening.
Oh, thank you. You're the master at drawing the truth out.
You're the master storyteller. So I guess if anyone is interested in finding more about Angela, look her up on the socials.
Yep.
I'll include all the links to where you could find her in the show notes.
Yep.
And thank you very much.
Thank you.
For coming on. Great. Thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed what you heard, I would really appreciate it if you could leave a review in iTunes. All the show notes for this episode can be found at voxclip.com. Next week, I catch up with Jen Y, mindful success coach and leadership development consultant. She's on a mission to teach others to live a more present and insightful life. Hope to catch up then.